listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Martin Page. Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon. Bobby Summerfield. Andrew Sheps. And last but not least, Rob Arbiter.
What am I doing here? Did I not get some memo?
Actually, there's a lot of guys that didn't make it, but we do have some people. We have some guests here today that'll kind of help us fill out the panel. And we're going to start with Ken Kane. Ken is our engineer.
Ken's joining us.
Hi.
Hey, Ken.
Howdy.
And today we actually have a guest.
A special guest.
Yes, because we're going to do something just a little different. Today our guest is Dr. Steve Labkoff. Steve, welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Thanks very much.
And the reason why Steve's here is because we're going to be talking a little bit about health in the studio, and just keeping a healthy lifestyle in production in general. So Dr. Steve is
in the house.
He's in the house. But also, I'm going to actually have him tell you his official title, because there's no way I could have remembered that. So Steve, what's your official title?
So I'm a senior director of global medical at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in New York, and I've been there the last 11 years.
Wow. And he actually has a really good voice, because doesn't he sound really good?
Yeah, he does.
Well, thank you for joining us, Steve, and we look forward to your input. But before we get going, I want to talk a little bit about a few things. Number one, I just finished this film. It was a documentary that I was mixing, and it was mixed in 5.1, and I actually had to put a 5.1 system in my studio. And it was not cheap, but I put the system in. And I was asked by a friend of mine while I was putting it in whether or not he should put a 5.1 system in his small little studio. And the first question I asked him was why? And he was saying, well, he sees all these other pictures of studios that have 5.1 in them. And I want to ask you, Rob, right now, if you were buying a speaker system, would you put the money into a good stereo system, or would you splurge for a 5.1 system for future recordings, as he tried to tell me that's the reason why he wanted to do it?
Well, I mean, it's really just a matter of if you plan to do that kind of work or not. If, assuming we're not talking about a home theater, which is just for enjoyment, if we're talking about for a studio,
right?
If you think you're going to be doing 5.1 work, it's probably better to get a 5.1 system and get used to it, know what everything's going to sound like. And then when the 5.1 work comes, you're already set up and ready to go. It's a little more complicated if you buy a stereo setup and then later want to expand it to a 5.1.
Right.
You may not be able to get a center speaker that matches your left and right exactly. There might be other issues. And also, it's like learning a new listening environment again. So I don't know if it's right or not, but my recommendation would be, like when I rebuilt my studio, I did put in a 5.1 system. Not that we had any particular 5.1 work booked, but we knew we were going to be doing some in the future.
But what if you're mainly, as this guy is, into music? I mean, I just don't see a 5.1 outlet for music, to be honest. Super audio CDs are dead, and I don't know. Ken, if you were right now, you're going to open up a studio, a small studio, would you put the money into 5.1, or would you go with a good stereo system?
I would have to go with 5.1.
Really?
That's just because I do post as well as music.
Yeah, once again, it comes down to if you think you're going to be using them for your work, if you think you're going to have a project that's going to need the 5.1, it's better to get it from the beginning.
I agree with the post.
Unless it ends up being a terrible 5.1 system where you could use the same money to get a better stereo system.
Well, that's the thing. It's really, I guess you're right, dependent upon how much. But like I said, a friend of mine, he's totally into music, and he was just thinking about it into a music kind of a thing. And I just thought it was a waste. You know, I think he's just stressing out for no reason at all. He should put the money in to a good stereo system.
Yeah, unless he needs it for his career. I mean, if he's just doing straight stereo music, then yeah, there's really no point.
I don't know. If you're getting a paid gig and you're working in your stereo music, you can still take your stereo music to the stage.
It's nice if you're going to be doing some music that's going to end up on a surround project. Even if you don't worry about the surrounds, it's nice if you can deliver left, center, right.
If you're
doing a song and you want to mix the vocal center and the track more left and right and do a nice blend across the front three speakers, it's better if you're going to ever need to deliver that way to be mixing that way. It's not the same thing to just bring a stereo track and then split it out later.
All right. I still think you should go with a good stereo system, but well, I understand what you're saying.
If the budget is limited, it's better to buy two great speakers than five terrible ones.
Well, you know, the thing is you see a lot of people who buy gear because of the pictures in Mix Magazine or an EQ, and they see a nice, you know, surround setup, and they think they need a surround setup. And it's just, you know, take the money, buy a good stereo setup, and...
And use the one at work for 5-1.
There you go.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, or even rent, you know, because it's just not cheap to go up, and better to put that in really good stereo.
Yeah, there's no avenue right now to be delivering real 5-1 music that's taking off in any kind of huge way. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, and there's no delivery system. I mean, the DVD audios never really took off, and I just wanted to get your input on the 5-1 versus stereo, because he was going to sink like $7,000 into a 5-1 system.
I'm much more for getting fewer great things than a whole bunch of mediocre.
I know a guy that lends his 5-1 systems out for months on end.
Really?
Yeah. This guy right here.
Oh, okay. So I'd say do that. I'd say buy a stereo system and then borrow a 5-1 setup from Mike.
Well, if you're out there and you're contemplating a 5-1 system and you really don't have any need for it, don't. You know, don't do it just because of a nice little picture that you saw in some magazine.
And also, if you do want to get some surround stuff going, do know that it's not the end of the world if your rear speakers are not the same as your front speakers. You know, you can spend a bunch of money on the good left, center, right for the front of the room,
right,
but the surrounds in a theater are never the same as the front speakers. You know, theoretically on a perfectly calibrated DTS surround music system, the rear speakers are the same, but there's no shame for a smaller setup in spending the money more on the front speakers, getting something lesser for the rear, and then you do have surround, but you've put most of the money in the front where it should be.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, the other thing I want to talk about was when I was working on this film that I just finished, I had a really unique workflow in that there was no drives that went back and forth. Everything that I got to mix was either uploaded on an iDisk or was FTP'd to me. And let me just tell you, that's just a brilliant workflow. You know,
it was
one of the first projects where I didn't use a physical drive to get stuff back and forth. You know, a lot of it was just uploaded to FTP, and then you just download it and you keep going, movies, things like that. The one thing that was brought over on a disk drive was the 20 gigabyte QuickTime file.
Yeah.
Because there's just really no quick and easy way to do that. But it's really exciting with the way technology is, especially with broadband and everything, to be able to collaborate with people and be able to work in a new environment when you've got sound effects editors that live in one city, and you've got, you know, music people that live in another city, and you've got the picture editor in another city, and you're collaborating with FTPs and with iDisks, and we're having, you know, conference calls with Skype. It was beautiful. It was a great, as far as communication and the workflow, just was amazing. And I wanted to talk to you, Rob. Have you found that, you know, with the internet and the broadband, the high speed, has it really made you more efficient? Do you still?
Absolutely. I actually had a thing happen last weekend. We mixed that film Devil Girl last year, and they're mastering the DVD now, and they needed us to do an AC3 encode, a Dolby Digital version of the soundtrack for consumer DVDs. And I did the AC3 encoding, and instead of you know, having to deliver a disc or CD-ROM or whatever, the whole soundtrack ended up, the Dolby file ended up being about 260 megs, which is on the border of, you know, what's convenient, but if you have fast connections, it's fine.
Yeah.
I put the file up on our FTP site. I gave an account to the supervisor in Denver, which is where the disc was put together.
Right.
He downloaded it Saturday and had the whole thing done by Sunday night. And my least favorite part of the entire production process, for whatever reason, is labeling discs and tapes. I hate labeling discs and tapes. It's just such a pain. It goes back to the days when you'd have to put the DAT label in the typewriter and it would never fit right. But even now, printing CD labels
Wait, you put the DAT label in the typewriter?
Oh, yeah.
I never typed a DAT label.
I always typed a DAT label.
Haven't you guys ever heard of brother touch type?
The P-touch?
Label, P-touch?
You know what? You have to put so much information on these tapes, you know, all the little time code rates and everything. There's a lot of information that has to go on there. I really hate labeling discs, and I have the, you know, the printers that can print right on the CDs. It's just an extra step that I hate. But if all I have to do is take a file, like this AC3 file, one big file, I drag it to a directory and I call the guy and I say, it's there.
Yeah.
Go take it. And then he takes it and we're done.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant.
It is great. And I mean, we were going to have to, originally the filmmakers thought we'd put this on a CD-ROM and then they'd FedEx it over. You know, all that just goes away. There's no labeling the media. There's no FedEx. It's really excellent.
The other nice thing about it is it's a really great backup. I felt like as long as the OMFs were up and the files were up on the FTP.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It's just like an external backup.
Yeah, you have like an external backup, and should anything ever happen, you know, you can always download it again.
It's been a long time since we've sent discs or tapes back and forth. All of the TV promo work we do, we're generally getting the, because it's short stuff, it's like 30 seconds or a minute long, we'll get the video by FTP and we'll deliver the audio by FTP. The only part we haven't worked out is they still have to mail us a check. They're not willing to do a transfer for something.
They won't PayPal you?
No, they won't PayPal us. No, we should get to work on that, actually.
That's pretty funny.
But, yeah, the new workflow with just being able to send the files around is great. And iDisk is great. For any customers of ours who are completely non-technical and you say FTP and their eyes roll over in their head, they can all understand iDisk or even iChatting files between people.
Yeah. If they're small enough.
Is there a size limit to what you can iChat?
No, but I do know that larger files take a little bit longer when you do that. But it's if you have like an MP3 and you want to just show a comp or to a client or something in there on iChat.
Oh, it's so fast.
You know, it goes really quick. Technology is just you blink and the workflow just changes. I remember when we got fiber over to post-production place, and fiber is a really super high-speed, basically internet connection, and we would be able to play a digibeta and have the client, who was one of the studios, I was working on a campaign for them, and they would see in real time the picture and the mix that I was having in my room, and so we'd play it back, and then we'd have to make changes, so I would make the changes to the mix through the fiber that they were seeing in their office. It was really kind of cool, the fact that we were playing everything off the machine in my place, but they were located 50 miles away doing
And they're watching it in real time.
Real time, uncompressed,
Steve and I were talking about this earlier. Do you know how much faster fiber is than like regular Ethernet or anything?
The fiber that I'm talking about isn't like the Fios fiber. It's actually a really fat pipe that a lot of production companies use to studios to see it. I mean, because you're talking about uncompressed, video.
If you're talking dark fiber, one of the things I used to do at Pfizer was I was a technology manager there for 11 years, and we had to lay out cables from New York to Morris Plains, New Jersey, and we had to work with AT&T to lay out something called dark fiber, which I guess Ethernet at the time was 1 megabit, and this was like 15 or 20 times faster than the fastest network connection we had in the building. It was much faster than what we could do
internally. This is the fiber that I'm talking about. Basically, what you do is you call up the phone company and you say you want to have a fiber, and they open the spigots at both ends. So it's not like it's open all the time. It's there. They open the spigots and then you shoot the data across it at an insane speed, and then it hits the other side and it gets converted back, the audio and the video, and then they're watching it. The funny thing is we did all this and they were on speakerphone. So I actually couldn't hear my mix in the studio. I had to turn my mix all the way down so that I could hear the speakerphone on top of the mix. So it was just barely there. So any changes that I was making, I was listening to the speakerphone to see, hey, can you bring up that swoosh a little bit? So I'd bring it up visually. I could see it, and then I'd hear it go up over on there. It was kind of funny.
You'd be listening back through the
speakerphone. So here they are spending thousands of dollars, so it's uncompressed and they have this great fidelity on their side, but I'm making changes based on the speakerphone. It was pretty funny. But yeah, but technology and the workflow, it's just amazing how it just keeps getting better and better and better. And pretty soon, when we have all those holographic crystals with the whole thing on it. Yeah, here's all my work from last year on the size of an ice cube. But, I was just amazed at how smooth it went with the whole workflow, because it was one of the few times where I've done a project where most of the stuff's came through on the internet.
I'll tell you, the only thing that I actually noticed, things happen so much faster. It used to be when you would send a tape to somebody for an approval or whatever, you could take a break.
Yeah.
There used to be time to relax during the process, because clients never want you to relax. They want you to keep going and going and going. And they never want any downtime. And the problem now is there really isn't any downtime. You can get any file to them. You know, even this quarter of a gigabyte file that we had to send to Denver, you know, that whole escapade was like a half hour. It wasn't a big deal. And then it's right back to work. It's pretty strange. You don't get that break time anymore.
Unless your internet connection suddenly goes down.
Yeah, or if you have to send it dial-up or something. then you get a day off.
You know what, Steve, let's talk a little bit about your job and about how you use technology in the medical field, just to so that people can get a little background.
Okay, so this is going to be kind of a little bit off topic from what you guys are discussing.
Hey, we had NASA scientists on before. So.
Okay. Yeah, I told Steve that. I said, you know, the definition of audio industry is very loose.
Yeah.
If it makes noise, it's in the audio industry.
Okay, well, I know how to make noise.
Right.
So the field that I have been working in for the last 11 years is the health information technology field. And the pharmaceutical industry is just one consumer of that, of health technology. In the broader sense, when you go to your doctor and your doctor takes notes and puts it in a chart, how that information is actually stored, saved, and shared is actually technically – the stuff you guys have here in the studio is light years ahead of what doctors have in their offices these days. And that creates a very serious problem. You're talking about sharing, you know, quarter gigabyte files to Denver. Well, your doctor would be lucky to be able to get, you know, a copy of an X-ray report, not even the X-ray, sent to him in real time as it's needed. So let's say you're in a car accident and you've taken to a hospital in Pasadena and you live in Irvine. You know, today, your doctor would be really, really hard-pressed to get the needed information to take care of you in an emergency. In certain communities around the country, they've been building out what's called a regional health information organization. And those regional organizations in cities like Spokane, Washington, and Boston, Massachusetts, and Indianapolis, Indiana, actually allow communities of physicians and hospitals and clinics and labs to all share information about patient records in a secure way, so that, you know, if you were in that car accident, the records would be available to that emergency room, or if you're a little old lady who can't remember what kind of pill she's on, those records would be available from the pharmacy, and you could actually practice medicine in a much more efficient manner. And the issues around all that are the kinds of things I've been working on through my various jobs at Pfizer. The pharmaceutical industry is a very data-rich industry, and they want to be able to use healthcare data, blinded healthcare data, data that's anonymized, to do things like try and find, you know, ways that medicines can be used for new reasons.
Right.
And as these health organizations grow, a byproduct of what they do is data. Well, one of my jobs has been to try and figure out how that data can be used for what we call secondary uses that are not primary clinical care,
right,
but for things like drug discovery or, you know, all these other types of functions.
Wow. So your concerns are not only data itself in the acquisition of the data, but also in the storage and the dissemination of the data.
Storage, dissemination, backup, security is a big deal.
That's pretty similar to, you know, the audio industry and what we're having to deal with as far as, you know, with data. And let me ask you a question. What do you back up your data on?
So on a personal level or at work? Because it's a big difference.
Well,
there always is.
Well, see, I mean, let's start with work. I mean, because that's such critical data that you have.
Right. So.
And you're going to want to have that data for a long time.
And, you know, in my industry, it's not just having it for a long time. There are legal reasons why we need to retain a lot of that data.
Right.
Data from a clinical trial, for example, might be needed for 15 or 20 years for the life that the drug's on the market, and then sometime after that.
Right.
And being able to get back to that information get back to it in real time and get back to specific assays or specific results to do retrospective studies is actually mission critical.
So what do you guys store your data on?
So there are specific backup routines that are used where they'll backup serve. So we have giant server farms located literally around the world. One of them happens to be in Groton, Connecticut, and they'll have guys who are paid and go around with the DATs, and they'll back up this stuff on DATs in a cycle. And I guess you guys have similar cycles. You know, there'll be a backup daily, and then they'll keep one tape and keep backing up daily. Then, you know, they'll have a cycle of a 90-day cycle of all these tapes per server.
Right.
And then after 90 days in a running sequence, they'll recycle. And they'll do it all over again.
So you still are backing up to a tape format then?
Yeah, they're still backing up most of that stuff to tape. And, you know, knock on wood, we don't generally have to rebuild all that frequently. But they, you know, they have to do this for medical legal reasons.
Right. Do they ever take any of their tapes and rebuild offline to like an offline server?
Oh, so they mirror. Yeah, so there are mirror sites as well. So you asked about backing up, but if you're talking about real-time recovery and fault-tolerant systems, those types of systems absolutely exist and are, you know, they'll have a mirror running. So Sandwich, England might be is another Pfizer location, and they may have a mirror of something going on in Groton. So that if there's and this happened over this past year, there was a power failure in the city of Groton, and for whatever reason, the backup generators didn't kick in properly, and the IT center went down. But they had recovery capabilities in other sites where the data would still be available, and it wasn't the disaster it could have been, although it was still pretty bad.
Right. Well, when I talk about taking your tapes and rebuilding to an offline server, just to make sure that those tapes are good to be able to.
So one of the things that I've learned the hard way is that backup is great. Taking your backups and testing them to make sure that they actually work
that's
is even
about.
Better.
Yeah.
And that's so, you know, on a personal note, at home, I do a lot of, you know, I putter around with video editing, and I keep all the projects I do, I don't compress them. I keep them in the Final Cut formats that I'd use them in. But I now back everything up to a terabyte drive that's a RAID 1 system. So I have, because I just had a crash, I lost all my audio files, all my MP3s, 100 gigabytes worth of MP3s.
Wow.
Went bye-bye, but I had a backup.
Oh, good.
And it wasn't my iPod. I didn't have to send Tui it or whatever to pull it back off the iPod. But I actually had a backup that worked. And that prompted me to go out and buy this it was a 2 terabyte Western Digital, what they call it, I guess, MyBook is the name of the brand.
Right.
And so I took the 2 terabytes, rated it down to 1, and have a mirror going of all my data and all the Macs in my house. And every kid, and both my children have a Mac and my wife has a Mac. And now with Time Machine running, they all back up to my terabyte drive, and everybody's happy, and I'll never lose my music again.
And wasn't it an amazing feeling when you realized you had a backup?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, it was also an amazing feeling to realize that my 250 gig drive just crapped out for the third time after being reformatted low level, and nothing could save it.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's the thing, boy. Once you start getting into those, you know, 100 gigabyte, 200 gigabyte drives, that's a lot of work that can go just in a split second. It was, you know, when I was working on this film, every night before I left, I'd make a complete backup of the whole mix, and I'd take it on a drive as well as leave it on a backup drive here and then the original work drives, because, you know, I just get paranoid after all that work, you know, and I want to save everything. I want to be able to, if this place caught on fire, let's hopefully
Yeah, really. We're all not going to.
But I just want to be able to, you know, there comes a moment in time where your work becomes more valuable than anything else, you know, especially after all the work that's been into acquiring all the elements and shooting all the video and all that. It's just, you know, those drives start become more and more valuable.
So when you asked me to sit down here tonight, you said, let's talk about, you know, healthy habits and such.
Yeah.
So one way to reduce stress in your life, actively back up.
That is really true.
That is so true. And we are going to talk a little bit about that in the second half. But that's interesting though about the amount of data that you guys, do you have any idea how much data you're dealing with? Are you dealing with?
It's a lot of data. So if you consider that every clinical trial has something on the order of 1,000 to 3,000 patients, and the clinical trials kick in at phase one, which is after the discovery phase, any particular molecule's life history probably comprises multi-terabytes of information over the course of time. And all that data needs to be accessible, recoverable, and stored for basically forever until the drug's off the market, and sometimes even longer than that.
Wow. That's a lot of information. Have you looked at any long-term situations? Because obviously tape is not a long-term format. I mean, how are you going to keep this alive for 20, 50 years? Or optical or in holographic or any of the
– While I worked in this space in the company, I didn't work on the lowest – lowest level. I didn't work in that framework of the IT group.
Right.
The things I was working on were kind of – you know, if you think about layers, my layer was kind of at a higher layer than some of the stuff we're describing here.
I got you.
So I can't answer the question. I don't know what their strategies are, but trust me, they have strategies.
Oh, I believe you.
Now, until, you know, not too many years ago, this stuff was kept in paper.
Right.
Because all these studies and many studies even to this day are, you know, clinical trials and medical records, as we talked about earlier, are kept on paper. And, you know, that has to be stored in, you know, humidity-controlled vaults and and all this.
But is all of the – like at Pfizer, is all of the data live all the time?
No.
So you would have to go back. If you wanted to see some old stuff, you'd have to restore it.
Well, I guess the answer to that is it depends. So the latest kinds of stuff is available. But older things like a drug that we make called which is an anti-epileptic drug, is a really old drug.
Right.
The clinical studies for were – invariably done on paper, probably like 60s or 70s, whenever the drug came on the market.
Right.
Computers weren't even available in that time frame. But they were required by law to maintain those records, and the records definitely exist someplace in some vault somewhere, probably 200 feet under the ground in a humidity-controlled space.
That's amazing.
And there's giant teams of people whose job it is to find that stuff when
– you ever think about the last scene in Indiana Jones?
Yeah, with the guy sitting at the low desk,
with the warehouse and
right.
It's probably it's probably a little like that.
Yeah, probably so.
Okay, well, that's really interesting about the data backup and everything that you do over there at Pfizer. And I would imagine you're right. They probably do have a plan for a long term solution that involves more than just a bunch of crates in a giant warehouse.
I'm certain of it. There's folks who paid big bucks to think of those things through and make disaster recovery plans. And, you know, I know that they have disaster recovery, like, officers.
Sure.
You know, one guy whose responsibility is to make sure that the plan is there, the plan's been tested, the plan – and they even go to use Six Sigma for this kinds of stuff. You know what Six Sigma is?
No.
Six Sigma is a process for doing repeated business processes nearly perfectly. One sigma is one standard deviation off the mean.
Right.
Six Sigma is six standard deviations off the mean, which is five nines of repeatability. You know, 0.99999.
Oh. Wow. That's pretty much the way we operate here at the Audio Nowcast. So I can totally relate to
that.
Yes,
we operate one over that. One divided by that.
Hey, Rob, why don't you tell everybody a little bit more about Steve, besides being the doctor. He was also has the honor of being...
He's the first recording artist I ever worked with. I will spill the beans here. I've known Steve since we were in eighth grade together.
Wow.
In Abington, Pennsylvania. We've known each other a really, 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 really long time. But we both had a real interest in music even back then, and I guess before then, but that's when we met. And back in those days, I was a bit of a gadget freak. Nothing like today. But
his bedroom in those days looked very similar to his studio today, which
studio
is really
now.
Scary.
In my bedroom at my parents' house, I had, you know, little – it was either a stereo or a four-track tape recorder, and I was always trying to figure out a way to get some kind of recording equipment. But Steve was the first friend I had who came over and played guitar and sang, and I recorded it.
Wow.
And he actually made me sound pretty good.
Made him sound pretty good?
Do you have these recordings?
And he was, I do,
so,
actually. I do.
He has them, and I have a copy of them too. They're on a reel-to-reel tape.
They go way back, but he was a good artist. Luckily, he didn't need auto-tune because there was no such thing. And it was all just recorded on my little it started as a Radio Shack tape recorder, but then it ended up being a TAC. But we used to just goof around and record songs, and neither one of us ever lost the passion for the music. And I mean, Steve is not doing it for a living now, but it's still a huge part of his life. And I mean, he's getting his kids, you know, they seem to have the same passion for it. I've obviously never lost the passion for it. And we started absolutely together. And even though our lives have taken these different paths over the years, the real core of love for music hasn't changed.
Wow.
So whether you're doing it for your career or not doesn't actually change how you feel about it.
It's a passion regardless. Well, hey, listen, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about our health. We got a doctor here, and we're going to talk about...
We're going to do some sit-ups
during
the break.
Staying healthy in the studio, having a healthy environment.
That's going to be a short conversation.
And everything to do with our health, because we care about you here at the Audio Madcast.
That's true.
So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and we're here with Dr. Steve Labkoff. And right now, we're going to talk a little bit about, well, just being healthy. And I bring this up because, as I mentioned in the first half of the podcast, I just finished this film, and let me tell you, it was a grueling, grueling experience. In one week, I did 3 all-nighters, and I worked my butt off, and I never felt more miserable when I was done with a project. And it was really, I think it got to the point where it probably was a little dangerous because I was just so exhausted and I just did too much. And a lot of it was, I underestimated the amount of work that had to be done. And a lot of it was, I underestimated the amount of changes the client.
Well, they changed the amount of work that had to be done
right? Yeah, that's true too. I mean, it went basically from a stereo project to a full 5-1 feature project, and it multiplied the requirements by a factor of 10, especially when you're talking about, you know, mixing something for theatrical release as opposed to just a television. But I bring this up is I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that keep us as people that are into audio from being healthy. And Steve, maybe you can help us with some of the ramifications. But for instance, I know stress is a big part of our job. You know, whether you're in music or whether you're in post-production, there's a lot of stress. And I know you being, you know, a former cardiologist, you know, tell us a little bit about stress, and everybody knows why stress is bad, but give us a little medical background on why.
Well, actually, is stress bad? Is stress a problem?
Well, your body's been your body's been engineered to handle certain degrees of stress. And the problem is, just like anything else in life, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. And while, you know, your body's been geared so that, you know, the fight or flight response in its most basic form, stress is a good thing. Because if you're about to get eaten by a dinosaur or whatever, it's a good thing that you'll be able to mount a response and run away and hide and you know, live to see another day.
Right.
The problem is when your body is in that mode, certain hormones are released that cause things like your blood sugar to rise, for one example. And your blood sugar rises because in a stressful situation you need to have access to energy, and energy is needed to run away and hide or fight, for that matter, whatever you're going to do. But if you're in that mode all the time, those hormones are released – and your body gets into a mode where it's constantly having a high sugar level, for example. And over the long haul, that can become deleterious to, you know, your well-being.
Wait, can that cause type 2 diabetes?
Well, it won't cause type 2 diabetes per se, but it certainly won't help it.
I got you.
Being overweight, getting no exercise, actually being overweight is probably one of the biggest risk factors for type 2 diabetes that's out there. And, you know, you ask about the risk factors of what you guys do. Well, I hate to say it, but what you guys do is no different than some senior executive in Wall Street or a senior executive at Pfizer or Stress is stress in whatever workplace you happen to be in.
We just do it in 5-1, though.
It seems so much more real here. It's true. But, you know, so there's the physical manifestations of stress can be harmful over time. But other aspects of stress – so when you're, you know, hunched over a keyboard and you're working without taking a break, you can actually cause your body physical harm that you may not appreciate. And it actually adds up over time. And it's not the same kind of stress that we're talking about in terms of, like, emotional stress. It's,
right.
Now we can talk about things like repetitive stress injury. So, you know, in my office, for example, I've been using a split keyboard for 10 years. My sister-in-law, who is an economist and works out of Boston, and she's in a high-stress job too,
right.
just had carpal tunnel surgery. And I'm guessing that's in part because – she typed a lot but was typing on a non-split keyboard and over time had a predilection to having that particular repetitive stress injury occur. And, you know, one of the things that Pfizer's kind of good at is they have physical – occupational therapists and physical therapists who go around the building and they scope out your workspace and they make sure your chair's at the right height and your monitor's at the right height and your keyboard is in the right position because in our environment you know, business people tend to run a pretty sedentary lifestyle too. And if you can eliminate things like even something as simple as getting the right kind of keyboard to work on,
right.
that can really cut down your risk for these problems long term.
Now, let me ask you a question. One of the things that I did was not sleep. And I know that's bad when you don't sleep. Believe me, I felt it. and why exactly – why is that such a bad thing? I mean, what are some of the physical things that your body goes through when you just deprive yourself of that much sleep?
Well, you're putting yourself into a constant stress mode, basically.
Really?
And, you know, other things that happens is that your mental functions will start to decline.
So no.
No.
Well,
yeah.
So speaking from someone who used to have to work every third night for nearly 40 hours,
right.
And – you know, on one occasion, actually, I got in a car accident coming off a call.
Wow.
So maybe it doesn't happen to you.
No, it did. Believe me.
I can tell you for sure that it happened to me. And when I was a resident in training, and in theory, residency programs aren't quite so rigorous anymore in terms of the hours you need to put in. But your mental faculties really decline over, you know, when you pull an all-nighter.
Yeah.
Is that just as a sidetrack, do you think that's a good thing to work people to that point? Is that
no, absolutely
toughening
not.
Them up in some
so
way?
So there's one rationale around it which says that the only way you learn how to treat certain kinds of diseases is to follow them through a night, overnight, and follow them in the course of the – as things evolve. And I have to say, in my experience, there is something to be said for that.
But be able to see the same patient through an entire process?
See the same patient through the entire process. And when you're working in an ICU setting, for example, that's quite important to, when you're in training. But the reality is when you're out of training, nobody works like that. You know, as an attending, you don't go in 24/7. That's not how it works as an attending physician anymore. But I think learning it at some point probably makes some degree of sense. Does it make sense to be on every third or fourth night for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years at a time?
Right.
I think that's ridiculous, and yeah. I think that the states have actually come and changed some of that based upon calamities that have occurred because residents were sleep deprived.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I've heard some stories about residency and how long they have to work. And
well, I remember when my brother was going through the process of becoming an anesthesiologist, I remember him telling me that there were some things that he got put through just because the generation before had been put through them, so they were going to put the next generation through
them. It's called hazing, and it's no different than a fraternity.
It's just amazing that is still like a reason for some things to happen, but it seems like it is.
I'd love to be able to sit here and say it doesn't happen anymore, but it absolutely still happens.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you that by the time I was done with that work week, I don't think I've ever felt as bad as I did at the end of the week. I mean, I was talking to my wife and I just told her I felt like I could, like, you know, I was, now I'm being a little dramatic, but I just said, I feel like I'm just, you know, steps away from, from it. That's it being gone. Because I was I was just so drained, and I had never been there. And that's when I thought, I go, you know, this is ridiculous. I should never, ever put myself in that situation again. It's not worth my health. It's not worth my life to be in that situation.
What's going to happen to you, and what happens to a lot of people, is that they have one seminal event in their lives and they say, screw it, I'm not doing this anymore. You know, one of the things that I used to do when I started working in the business world and left medicine, I started watching, you know, I had colleagues who never left the building, who just would work and work and work and work. And I had left cardiology years ago because I couldn't stand that kind of work-life balance, if you will. And one of the things that, you know, I just sort of set some parameters around how I would do my work. Now, I don't know if this can apply in your industry because, you know, different industries have different expectations. But one of the things I started doing was, you know, I learned how to, you know, I learned how to budget my time in a way where, you know, it was okay not to necessarily finish every single thing on the plate. In a scenario like you guys live in, the world where you live in, where you have these deadlines by big studios and such, that may not be a realistic option.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the deadlines and because you're right, in certain situations, working in audio, especially in post-production, we're like the bastard child. I mean, audio, it's all about picture at the top end. And what ends up happening is, let's say you have a project that's due June 1st and you scope out when you're bidding it out and they said, yeah, we'll have lock picture by, you know, the end of, April. So you're thinking, okay, I got all of May and I can start cutting before picture's locked. And so, yeah, we start in May, we can mix and we'll be done by June 1st. Well, invariably what ends up happening was, you know, picture gets locked May 14th, you know, and
the deadline never moves.
Exactly. And the deadline hasn't moved. And it's just all of a sudden, boom, you just lost 2 weeks. Well, where do those 2 weeks go? Well, those 2 weeks went, you know, instead of 4 weeks of 8-hour days. Now you're doing 2 weeks of 16-hour days. And
do you have any opportunity to negotiate with these clients and say, you know, look, I specced out. It was good. So this is something we're kind of famous for at Pfizer in some respects. I've watched people say, you know, they come to us and say, we want to train you in X.
Right.
And, you know, Pfizer, we're full of a lot of smart people. And we say, oh, you know what? We're smart. We'll get it done in half X or a third X. And they'll bring in the trainers and they'll take it for half a day or a third of a day. And then nobody ever learns the stuff like they're meant to because it actually was meant to take X.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to assume that the same kind of thing probably applies in your space. You can't do more work than time will physically permit.
Well, no, but there are some projects where you can throw more people at the project and get it done, but not always.
And fortunately, on this particular project, I actually ended up doing that, and believe it or not, and I still worked crazy hours because I'm working on a documentary, and part of the documentary is this typewriter, and it's a really signature sound, and there's probably, you know, a couple hundred edits of the typewriter, and I wanted to take the time to design the typewriter sound and cut it all in because it's an hour and a half documentary and that's the thing I wanted to do. It was kind of the signature sound. Well, I didn't have time, so I farmed that out because it was a couple hundred edits and each key hit of the typewriter was composed of three sounds and it was just pretty elaborate. So once I knew that, you know, it was going to start getting pushed as far as time goes, that's the first thing you do is you bring in somebody else, and so I brought somebody else in. You know, but the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to tag team mixing because I'm just not going to try to mix it all myself because it's just crazy. You know?
So there's one thing I've learned about in the business world that might apply here. I don't know if it does or not, but one of the things that I've learned about managing people and managing projects in my world has been around, you know, absolutely good expectation setting around project management is mission critical, and I got to believe that applies here as well because everything you're describing is nothing more than a complex project. It may be a different type of project, but it's still a project.
No, that's true.
And, you know, I've been through all kinds of business seminars around just the concept of setting expectations because if you were masterful at setting expectations, you can actually – get away with a whole lot more than you think you might be able to get away with. So, but you have to be masterful at it, and you need to be able to really make sure that every party involved in the project understands and gets expectations set as far out as possible. If you're able to pull that off, then it makes life in the course of the project much more sane.
I think, you know, I think some of that is applicable. I think if maybe throughout the editing, you know, I could have stayed on top of things and say, hey, we need to, you know, the deadlines, or perhaps maybe even just kept in communication a little bit. But there's
it's
other
so
projects.
It's so hard to stay objective though when you're in the middle of
it.
But, sure, you're nose down to the
But there's, but also there's other projects too though that that's not even an option because they're not going to listen to you in the first place. Because you'll get a director there and it'll be done when it's done. You know, I'm sure you, Rob, have come across situations like that where, you know, they're going to do it. They're going to do it their way. And when you get it is when you get it, and you'll be, you know, and you still are required to perform.
So this becomes a life choice, because ultimately speaking, you chose to take on that project and not call the studio back and say, you know, guys, I told you it was going to take 4 weeks. You've only given me two. It's still going to take 4 weeks. And, you know, unless you're going to, you know, pay me extra to bring in, you know, three times the manpower, it's going to take that 4 weeks. I don't know if you can have that conversation with these kinds of folks.
Well, you know what ends up happening? Like, I'm in the middle of that right now. We're doing a project for a huge studio. It's a video game. And we were supposed to start about a month ago, and it was going to have a five-week production period. And now, instead, the job is actually going to start tomorrow or the day after. And the first call that I made today was to make sure that the deadline wasn't now, you know, in a few days.
Right.
It starts, the 5 week clock will start ticking from now.
Right.
But we've done other jobs for the studio where they'll start the project 2 or 3 weeks late and not move the finish line.
Yeah.
And you have to be real firm about that. But the
Absolutely.
problem in our industry is no matter how insane the request is, if you're not willing to do
someone else will.
Yeah, that's
and it's a terrible little, you know, kind of juggling act you have to do to figure out what's truly not worth it. And it's amazing.
And,
you know, the competition.
You say my health will, you know, getting back to health, you know, people tend to get into patterns in their lives. And some people feel very comfortable under that kind of stress pressure. And therefore, they will engineer their lives in such a way that they will repeatedly find themselves in those situations. So you could argue that folks who get into that situation like it. And they keep doing it because it's something that they're emotionally attached to, because that's where they feel like they're on top of their game, and they're, you know, that's when they're most productive and most creative and
there's
such.
There's a lot of that.
Oh, I'm sure there's a huge amount of that. But, you know, if you look back at, if you take a step back from that and you look at the folks who are really doing fantastic work, my guess is, and maybe I'm wrong here, but my guess is that they're not working that way. My guess is they're probably working at a somewhat different pace. And I would also guess that they probably are doing as high quality or maybe even higher quality because they're doing things in different time frames. Maybe I'm wrong.
There's probably some truth to that.
I think there are people who have like extremely intense, like really successful people who have extremely intense periods, but then the most unbelievable vacations you've ever heard of. Like they can be at the most stressed out in the world and then they can completely shut it off. I have seen that in some super creative people.
Well, I also do know that, especially in our industry, that if you're good, you're going to be busy because people are going to use you. I mean, it's just as simple as that.
It's hard to turn down work because
when you're on the top of your game, especially, there's definitely an element of what you're talking about though. Post-production in general, there's a certain adrenaline rush to having those deadlines. And I'm kind of a junkie to that because some of the coolest moments are when you're in the middle of things and, you know, they have a buy, you know, the next day and you got to get this on the air. And that's like the manageable stress, I guess. That's the stress where you're not really stressed. You're just loving it.
You're motivated.
Exactly. You're kind of like the football player who's in that game, you know, and there's that stress of, are you going to win? You're not going to win. You're kind of like you're in.
Yeah, but the stress when you're actually in despair because you don't think you can finish and do a good job, that's not healthy stress.
And you know what?
I would argue that, you know, to some degree, both kinds are not healthy overall.
Really?
For a sustained period of time?
For a sustained period. For a short stint, that's great. You know, and when I was 18 or 20, I could pull 4 all-nighters in a week. And I did a fellowship project when I was working at Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston, where my final thesis project, I went literally 5 nights in a row with no sleep.
Wow.
Yikes.
But that was, you know, I can count on one hand and on one finger the times in my life where I did that, and that was the only time. Oh, I'm sorry. Then my kids were born, and I was born every night after that. But, you know, you could catch a couple winks in between diaper changes and feeds.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can say I like that that kind of stress. I kind of like the whole just coming down to the deadlines, those kind of things. I kind of dig that. I mean, not the all-nighters, but when you're working on something and there's a deadline and you're in production and you know, that's kind of like fun stress.
And when it's done, doesn't it feel good?
It does feel good.
Yeah. That's
the thing. When you've come through, when you can say, you know what, I've never missed a deadline. It's like, you know, you raise your hand, you feel like you've conquered the world. But I'll tell you the kind of stress that I was in, you know, last week when I was working on that film was it was miserable. And because for me, the added stress was, as I knew that my work could suffer and I couldn't let it suffer. Cause you know, you're not going to be watching a film in the movie theater and it's going to sound great and then it's going to sound really crappy and then it's going to sound good. I mean, it just has to be.
It's like a door closes, but instead you hear a duck quack.
But, you know, I think the stress factor is something. And I think I've learned a lesson and I don't think I'm going to put myself in that situation.
You will.
Let me speak to something else that you asked me to talk about, which is how do you get around the stress? What do you do to deal with it? And I think it's something, you know, a couple of things that if we have the time here.
Absolutely.
So if you talk about the kind of stress you're describing about these all-nighters and such, it's so vitally important to your body and your physical well-being to, like, take a break, you know, once in a while during a project. You know, don't pull that all – if you're going to pull the all-nighter, take 20 minutes out and lie down and, you know, put the TV on or, you know, veg out just to, you know, give yourself a break. Because those breaks are actually very important to your body, just sort of to regroup. If you're in that kind of mode, and look, everybody's going to be in those kinds of modes from time to time.
Right.
Getting exercise, taking a break, and you know, my wife is really good at this. She, you know, will stop doing whatever she's doing and she'll go do push-ups. That's not what I tend to do for losing stress. I'll pick up a Nintendo and play some video games. But you've got to break the cycle because it'll actually keep you sharper than if you stay grinding and all tensed up for the long duration. So exercising, get outside, get some fresh air, jog a little bit, do something that will change the environment and give your body a different set of stimuli. And exercising actually also releases endorphins, which will actually make you feel better in general. Endorphins are these natural chemicals in your brain that are opioids, which are related to opium from the name. And they actually make you feel good. And you can get those – your brain will secrete them when you exercise.
Wow. Well, you know, the one thing I did do was I did step outside. And it's funny. In Burbank, when you walk outside and you're pulling an all-nighter and it's like 3:30 in the morning and you're taking a 15-minute break, you know that – in this town, there's probably 100 other people that are doing the exact same thing.
I'll try 1,000, yeah.
A few thousand. But, you know what? That's a great idea as far as, you know, managing the stress and
I'll add one other thing. We talked about repetitive stress injury. This is something that you guys, I'm sure, are actually more victim to than you even realize. But I would personally strongly urge anyone who's listening to this and you guys at the table here, get yourself some split keyboards, for example, and, you know, if you've got somebody who's a physical therapist, have them come to see your studio and spec out whether or not your chair is in the wrong position or not, because believe it or not, you'll screw up your back and your neck badly, and you won't realize it, and you can prevent it. It's easy to prevent, to have those types of preventative maintenance things, if you will, done, you know, and check them occasionally.
Well, you're right about the chair, because that's the best investment one of the best investments you can make in your studio is to get a good chair, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, before we end, I'm just kind of curious, Rob, do you have any, like, just famous, just stressed out stories, like where you've just been totally on the edge, any project you ever worked on where you just pushed yourself to the point of like, oh my God.
I mean, way too many. I mean, we could do a series of podcasts on it. I can tell you what was my single most stressful moment ever. And it was the first tour I was ever on with Stevie. And he had a single out called Skeletons in Your Closet. This was like 1987, I think. But the record had just come out or was about to come out, and we were on tour in London, and we were going to do a show at Wembley. And he had told me before the show he wanted to edit out one of the choruses. We had some backing tracks and some synth sounds and things that were in the synclavier because there was no way to recreate them live. They were all studio tricks and stuff. And so he told me he wanted me to edit down the song. And I forget if it was taking out a bridge or shortening a chorus or just some basic edits on the song. And we weren't set up for any kind of editing work at all. And he told me this as the audience is already coming in for the show. You know, it's after sound check and it's almost showtime. I'd only been with him for maybe a year. I didn't even know him that well at that point. And he pulled me into his dressing room and said, you know, I need you to cut down the song a little bit. Well, I said I would do what I could do. I went under the stage, which is where the synclavier was set up back then because the show was in the round and all the big equipment was under the stage. I got under the stage. I had no way to monitor anything except somebody found a pair of headphones, and but they weren't long enough to reach me, so there were headphones from the monitor desk. Basically, what I had to do was I edited the song by hearing headphone bleed from the other side of under the stage. I could basically hear the drums a little bit, but there was this whole big audience filling into the arena, so I couldn't really hear what I was doing. The very first time that I ever heard my edits were during the show.
Oh, no.
There was no way to check it. And I have never been so nervous hitting play because, you know, the whole band and everything, Stevie, everything's going on above my head on this stage that I'm underneath.
Right.
And when those edits came, thank God they were musical and they turned out fine. But I've never been so nervous and so stressed out hitting play because also I was, what, 24 years old?
Wow.
You know, I was just starting out. I figured this could be career ending before it even started. I have never been that tense in my life. And when I hit play and the song played okay and I could hear the dancers on top of my head, we had this like dance troupe and everything, I heard it all go fine. I actually fell out of my chair and laid on the floor under the stage because I was that – I had been that tense. And then the release of it just being over, I had a physical reaction. It was horrifying.
Wow. That's man, that's I know.
And there've been plenty of things since then, but that one I'll never forget it because I was so new. I didn't you know, now I think of a lot of these people as friends. Back then, these were all very experienced professionals, Stevie and the band and everything, looking at this kid coming in. It's like, "Kid, don't screw up."
Hey Ken, what's your most stressful moment?
I think it was in the beginning when I was working with you at CCI and they'd thrown me into a 5-1 playback. It was Meatloaf. But, you know, I set the room up to what I thought was the right way, and everything was just coming out wrong. You know, I'm just sweating because there's a client behind me, and I'm really green at this time. And, you know, he's getting pissed off, and management's getting pissed off, and I'm pulling cables, and stuff is just coming out wrong. I mean, I stayed. It was only a playback. I wasn't even doing anything. Still, it took hours to get it right.
I remember that.
You do remember that.
Yeah, because he was covering for me because I couldn't be there.
It was crazy.
Well, what do you have, Steve, beyond the 5-hour or the 5-day all-nighters?
So my most stressful moment, I was a medical resident in my third year at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Presbyterian Hospital, and I was running the cardiac care unit. And around 10 o'clock at night, I had three patients independently code at the same time. And a code is when their hearts either stop or they the blood pressure bottoms out and they're basically trying to die on you. And I successfully kept all three of those patients alive until 6 a.m. when the next shift came on board, the attendings came back and kept these three people alive all night.
Yikes.
He wins.
But hang on a second. It's not that I win. I think that what it says is that in any – and I also was 24 at the time.
Uh-huh.
And
we might have been doing it at the same time.
Could have been the same night.
We should go back and figure that out.
The thing of it is, though, is that it outlines that it doesn't matter what field you're in. Every field, every job, every whatever – we'll face these types of things,
right.
And you know, whether it's you're trying to do something in the audio industry or in medicine or whatever, everybody's when they're early on in their careers are going to have these types of things, and it's hard to get through. And the guys who do it well and start to thrive on it, they're the ones you got to worry about because when they're in their 40s, their bodies aren't what they were in their 20s, and they can't do those same kinds of things, you know, for the long, long haul.
Yeah, you got to find a balance.
Yeah.
You know, the mix that I just finished was very stressful. Being up, you know, those three all-nighters was definitely stressful, but the most stressful moment that I've ever had in my career was working with Teddy Riley over at his studios in Virginia Future Studios. And they bring me in. I've designed this big Mac, you know, MIDI system. I'm going to convert all his sequences off an Atari to Vision. And they've brought me over a week. I've spent like 4 days, you know, covering all his sequences and transferring them all into the Mac. And he comes in for the playback. And I hit play. It just comes out like a, I don't know, like a four-year-old playing on a sampler. I mean, it sounded so bad. I mean, it was comical how
just
bad
all
it
wrong
sounded.
Sounds.
Just all things just not assigned right, and just it was just all crazy. And I'll never forget. He walked outside. He was in there for a second. I was totally apologizing. I just said, you know, it's a little something. Just give me a little bit of time. And then he walked outside. He was really calm and he walked outside. And then in comes his engineer. And he just says, Teddy just wants you to get your boop together. and luckily it was pretty easy. I had a MIDI filter in that was just doing some really bizarre stuff through the MIDI. You know, this is all the days where you had racks of samplers and things like that. Uh-huh. So it was a pretty easy fix. But that one moment was probably the most stressful moment that I've ever had, because it's just like colossal, total failure in front of the biggest client that I've ever worked with.
This might make you feel better. The person will remain nameless, but it was a keyboard tech who worked for me in the early days with Stevie too. And we did a TV show. I forget where it was. It was either in Japan or London. But anyway, Stevie was going out on live TV. It was a live show. We had the band there. And the singers, but it was sort of one of those top of the pop shows, and it was a lip sync thing. So the band is playing along. The singers and dancers are kind of doing their thing. Stevie sings live because he never lip syncs.
Right.
But the music was just coming off a CD because there was no setup time to do sound checks or anything. So the music came off a CD and Stevie was going to sing. And this guy's job was to start the CD, and he started the wrong song on live national television.
Oh, that's
so he had one of those moments, you know, my Sinclair moment under the stage at least had a happy ending.
Yeah.
This one was not a happy ending. And then, of course.
And he now sells insurance.
Well, I'll tell you this, he doesn't do that kind of work anymore, but very nice guy, but he had started the wrong song. And then when you're that nervous and that freaked out and realize you've made the mistake, even the simplest thing like trying to find the right song,
yeah,
forget it. Even if all you had to do was skip one to the right, you know, in that moment of panic, you just can't find the buttons. And yeah, the wrong song played for about 10 seconds.
Well, you know, we're going to have to do a podcast where all we do is war stories about stress. Because we could just keep going.
Try to stress out the audience.
Well, Steve, Dr. Steve, I should say, thank you so much for joining us here on the Audio Nowcast and for having a really good discussion about stress. Before we go, do you have a couple really good tips to add on top of all the stuff that you said? Anything about maybe hearing or
yeah, we haven't even talked about hearing, which is what you might think would be the number one problem for us guys.
Yeah, but I think the stress thing is really important because I think
it goes underestimated.
Yeah,
people
it really
don't
does.
Appreciate, but so you know, I'm sitting around this table and we're a bunch of 40-year-olds. When we were all in our 20s, stress was a whole different beast. You know, in your 40s and when you're in your 50s. This can cause heart attacks, and this isn't hypothetical. I had a colleague who I went to medical school with. He started late. He graduated when he was 44, and literally the day before graduation, he started having chest pain, and he ignored it. And the guy died the night before graduation from medical school because he didn't pay attention to symptoms. I guess one thing I would say to the audience is listen to your body. If your body is having pains or aches or symptoms that, you know, you just start to ignore, worse than stress is ignoring your body telling you something. If your body's telling your wrist hurts, well, if it's telling you pain is there for a reason.
Right.
If you're getting chest pains, go to a doctor, see somebody. don't ignore it. Maybe it's something as simple as indigestion, but maybe it's not. And even young guys can have heart attacks, especially if they're taking part in illicit activities that might stress their hearts more than they should. You know, to keep up late at night, maybe they're doing, you know, sensory-enhancing experiences. But all joking aside, the one piece of advice is listen to your body and go see your doctor. Men especially in their middle age years, don't go to doctors. Don't get the care that they need to get for just preventative maintenance.
Right.
You'd never take your car and drive it for 20,000 miles without changing the oil. Why would you go 5 years without seeing your doctor and making sure that your heart's okay and that your GI system's okay and, you know, all these things? I mean, you treat your car better than you treat yourself.
That's true. No, that, you know, it's funny you should say that, because actually about 5 years ago, I was in a session and I actually had to go. For some reason, my heart just took off and it started beating really fast. And I knew something was kind of up because I felt the pain in my throat, and it wasn't even pain. I just felt the beating in my throat. And it's like, man, it should not be going this fast. And so my client, who's actually a really good friend of mine still to this day, he actually took me to the emergency room, and it was, my heart rate was just outrageous. It was way up there, you know, in the 200s. And they actually had to, well, you were telling me what they use some drug.
Yeah, they use a drug called.
Yeah.
And what it does is it depletes the heart of the energy chemical, right, temporarily.
Yeah.
And the heart will literally stop for 15 to 20 seconds,
yep,
and it will restart.
Yeah.
So you could argue that you were clinically dead for 15 to 20 seconds.
It was the weirdest thing in the world, because I remember the doctor coming up and said, you know, I'm going to give you a drug, and we're going to reboot. You know,
rebooting your heart, exactly.
Yeah, we're going to reboot your heart, because he knew that I was, you know, a mixer from our little small talk and everything. And I just remember laying there on the table, and he kept the syringe behind his back, and then he said what he was going to do, and he brought it out, and he stuck it in my arm. And then my field of vision was like, if you were, could imagine a TV set and doing like a shutter wipe where the ends come in and it just got really small and then it opened up again. It was the weirdest,
wow,
thing in the world. And
if you think that's weird. I mean, imagine being the guy. So you're the 26-year-old resident who's doing that to somebody for the first time.
Yeah.
That's also stress.
I can imagine.
Yeah, really.
But no, but it's true. It's like if I hadn't listened and I actually ended up going to the doctor and, you know, do the EKG and, you know, and I was in my 30s and haven't had any, you know.
Well, can that turn into a heart attack if your heart races
that? Well, actually, here's what can happen. And the answer is yes and no. A heart attack, the generic term heart attack, implies a lack of oxygen to a part of the heart, and that could be caused by a number of different things. It could be caused by a blood clot. It could be caused by a piece of cholesterol breaking off in the artery and then obstructing the artery. Any of these things can cause a heart attack. Another thing that can cause the heart attack also is a low blood flow state. And when your heart is racing at 200 beats per minute, it doesn't pump efficiently. And when it doesn't pump efficiently, you won't get the perfusion of the heart to the same degree. Perfusion means the amount of blood going through the blood vessels in the heart. The heart has its own arteries and veins,
right,
that feed it. And when your heart races that fast, the way it could cause a heart attack, let's say you're 45 years old and you have the beginnings of coronary artery disease and you happen to pop into one of these, what they call a supraventricular tachycardia or a rapid heart rate, as you described, that can precipitate a heart attack. And if it gets too fast, it can kill you. And you're very fortunate that you were young enough at the time that this didn't happen, because young people can tolerate that kind of a heart rate for, you know, extended period of time.
Right.
If you were 60 years old, could have been a whole different ballgame.
Oh, that's true. But what you said is, boy, listen to your body. Because if I hadn't, because there was thoughts of like, don't worry about it, you know, it'll go away, or you're just nervous, or you're just, you know, you're amped up on, you know, Diet Coke or something. But I just, for some reason, I knew it was serious.
You just said something else that amped up on Diet Coke. Caffeine can cause things like that to happen. And, you know, stress and caffeine and cigarette smoking, these are bad things. You know, cut back on the Diet Coke, cut back on the coffee, you know, get some exercise, get some fresh air. I realize the air out in L.A. is not the best to go outside in, but.
Okay, doctor, I'll be better. All right, well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. It's been really, thank you so much for coming out here. And you know, if you're out there, I know it's a little different, you know, podcast, but really a lot of us who work in the studios, or even if you just do audio and do music part-time, you really got to think about your health, and you really got to think about the big picture, because as much as we like what we do and as much as we like, you know, being involved in audio, there's nothing that we do. There's no piece of gear, no mix, anything that's worth, you know, your health or my health. And just don't put yourself in those situations. Before we get going, Rob, do you, you've been working on anything interesting besides staying alive? And
I thought the Bee Gees broke up.
Yeah. No, we're bringing it back together. No, based on what Steve was saying, I have to just start treating my car like crap so that it seems like I treat myself better. No, I've been, I'm starting on a couple projects that I can't, talk about yet, but things are pretty cool. I mean, the new furniture is now in and all the equipment is wired, and we're actually finally getting work done on it, and I've stopped thinking about what a nightmare it was to get it all together, and it's really been exciting. Doing anything, we've talked about it before, but changing your workspace, just even rearranging the room, can often be a real inspiration. And I remembered it as a kid. I would just, like, even rearrange my bedroom, and that would, like, give me some little inspiration just because things were a little bit different. Yeah. I think most kids do that. Most kids do that. But the same thing has happened in the studio, even though it's, you know, basically the same gear, but it's just laid out differently, and it's been kind of an invigorating thing. It's been cool.
That's great. Ken, you working on anything?
I'm actually finishing a series, and I have some time off, which I'm very happy about. So I'm going to do a little relaxing, and I'm going to get my health in order.
There you go. While you're still young.
While I'm still young.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm definitely gonna try to de-stress my life, because I've been to the bottom and now I want to go back up, you know, and Dr. Steve, we're gonna call you the official doctor of the Audio Nowcast.
That's great. I've never had an official title of this guy.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate all your free advice. And
did anyone say it was free? I don't remember hearing that.
I thought this was gonna buy me an advanced copy of some
something good. We'll see what we can do.
Cool. All right. Well, if you've got any questions or comments, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also check out our MySpace page. That's myspace.com/audio nowcast. So for myself and all the guys and Dr. Steve, and we're all going to be way more healthier now. All you guys out there, you be healthy too, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Dr. Steve, can we call you the official doctor of the Audio Nowcast?